And welcome to the third day of South by Southwest Interactive. My name is Christy Naughton, and I'm one of the Interactive Festival producers. Before we get started, I wanted to take a moment to thank a few people, thank our wonderful sponsors, our army of volunteers, but most importantly, I wanted to thank you, our South by Southwest community. Give yourselves a hand. Yeah! I wanted to thank you all for making this a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful event. And I got a few reminders. Today is the last day of the Screenburn Arcade at the Palmer Event Center. Be sure to stop by there, and be sure to stop by the Power Up closing party there from 6 to 8, I believe. Check your schedules. And also, I wanted to remind you that you can catch the campus shuttles at Trinity Street. They go to all of our 15 campuses, so you can get to wherever you need to go really quickly. And I also wanted to let you know that our 3:30 session, right here in Exhibit Hall 5, Katarina Fakes' The Love You Make has canceled. But never fear. Instead, Kevin Systrom will take you inside Instagram. So you won't want to miss that. Right here, 3:30, right after this session. And now to the business at hand. As an avid science fiction fan with a minor in cultural anthropology, I am not only interested in the work of today's keynote speaker, Amber Case, I think it will play a vital role in our evolution as digital humans. I love what our mutual friend, photographer Chris Krug, says about Amber. She's from the future. She's come back to help us figure out how to think. Amber Case is a cyborg anthropologist and user experience designer from Portland, Oregon, who has been featured in Forbes, Wired, and many other publications, both in the United States and around the world. Case has spoken at TED on technology and humans and was featured in Fast Company 2010 as one of the most influential women in technology. Case's focus is in mobile software, the future of location, and wearable computing. She recently founded geoloki.com, a private, next-generation local platform, out of frustration with existing development tools and service in the location industry. I first met Amber last year at one of our pre-event mixers in Portland, Oregon. It was a dark and stormy night, like you get in Portland, so our party was off to a bit of a slow start. There was a handful of people there, and I looked around the room and noticed that they had all gathered into the corner. So there was this small gathering group of people focused in the corner, all with one woman, all looking at one woman. They were just hanging on her every word. That woman was Amber Case. Now, this room's a little bit bigger, a few more people, but I have a feeling that the effect is going to be just the same. We're all going to be hanging on her every word. Now, afterwards, she's going to do a small Q&A, and it'll be that microphone right out there. And I know you're going to want to stay for the entire thing because your questions make it all worthwhile. And now, I'd like to welcome Amber Case.
Hello, everyone. There are a lot of people in this room. How do so many people fit in one room? This is amazing. This would be the size of a small city in the medieval times, except everybody would have a lifespan of 20 years. So, how many people ate breakfast tacos this morning? You are all going to be okay. The rest of you might not survive through this session. So thank you so much. How are you enjoying South By? Yay! So I'm here to talk to you about ambient location and the future of the interface. But first, I want to ask all of you to hold up your phones as quickly as possible so I can see 3,200 tiny screens. Wow, that's a lot of screens. All right, the faster you held those up, the more you're all cyborgs. In fact, we're all cyborgs. The minute you look at a screen, you are in a symbiotic relationship with you and a piece of technology. So not Terminator, not RoboCop, all those are awesome movies. This is the guy who really inspired RoboCop and Terminator and things like that. I'll talk a little bit about him later. But every time you use an interface, you are in this symbiotic relationship. So let me give you a formal definition of cyborg really quick. It's an organism to which exogenous components have been added for the purpose of adapting to new ambient spaces, which really means People are weird. They like to go into weird spaces like space, or the bottom of the ocean, or the top of Mount Everest. And in order to do that, they have to put all of these external components on themselves in order to adapt to these new environments. So we're this very strange species that likes to do that, and that's where the word cyborg came from. But another thing that is curious, and why I'm really studying this subject and cyborgs, is because when you look at tools, most of the tools from the beginning of time were an extension of the physical self. Like a hammer, you extend your fist, you can pound on something and hopefully make, you know, a teepee or a tent. And it's very efficient as a tool. But it's definitely an extension of the physical self. Right now we're looking at extensions not of the physical self, but of the mental self. And they're very strange things, right? Because they don't really stay the same shape over time. If you look at a tool from 3,000 years over time, it looks the same way, pretty much. You know, it gets a little bit better. You can hit things harder with it. It's more precise. But the shape of the tool and its function are the same. But then if you look at a computer, what it looked like in the 1950s versus what it looks like now is completely unstable. The size and the shape and the design are not the same over time. It's completely amorphous. It's evaporating into thin air. So what I've been really interested in looking at is from solid to liquid in air, how interfaces evolve over time. So you have these buttons that are physical, and if you want to change what the button does, you have to go back into the machine, and then you have to toggle some wires, and then you change what that button does. And now we have these liquid screens where a button can show up at any point and do anything. And that's an infinite purpose screen, an infinite purpose device. So what's the next step? What's after the liquid interface? What is the next interface after that? And I'll talk more about that at the end. But first, a traditional anthropologist generally tends to go out to another country and say, oh, how fascinating these people are, how interesting they are. They have all these different rituals and tool sets and ways of living. And it's always from the perspective of somebody being an other. And so a traditional, a cyborg anthropologist does the opposite. They say, hey, look at these crazy people. They have these devices in their pockets that cry, and then you have to pick them up and soothe them back to sleep. And then they get hungry at night, and then you have to say, my device is hungry, and you have to go find an outlet and plug it in, and then it's slurping down all of the data, and then, you know, it's really hungry for money, and then if you keep it for 2 years, then it breaks, so you have to get a new one, and then you have to protect it so that if you drop one on the floor, your external brain doesn't break, and then, you know, and so on and so forth. And another curious thing is that these devices are larger on the inside than they are on the outside. So we all have these little Mary Poppins bags around. And Lisa Reichelt came up with this term called ambient intimacy. It's not that you have all these people around you all the time, but that at any point you could always click and be able to connect to anyone. And if you were to take all of these people, your tiny little village, all your contact book, and print it out, you would probably have a crowd that looks somewhat like this. This many people are in all of your phones. So technically, you're not 3,200 people. You're probably more like 50,000 or 60,000 people in this room, all packed in, because you can talk to all of these people at once. And then the other curious thing that I noticed is that you can keep lots of things in a space, and you can put many pieces of information, and yet your laptop or your phone doesn't get any heavier. And that really made me kind of curious, because one of these companies did a campaign for Maxtor, and they said, well, let's take, you know, 8 years of digital photos and let's print them out and see what's really in that computer. And so they printed it out, and this is what it looked like. So when you lose your files, when your computer crashes and you feel this sense of loss, you're losing like 2,000 pounds worth of stuff. But another thing I noticed is that it's really easy to hoard when you have a computer, because it's easier to consume things and save things than it is to get things out of the computer. So now you can take 100,000 photos and none of them end up on the fridge because it's harder to print them out. Or you can see somebody, you know, if you have like a crazy aunt who collects newspapers, like 10,000 of them, and her entire house is filled up, and you walk in, you're like, oh no, we need to get you help. But if you have somebody on a computer and they have taken 100,000 photos and like they're waiting in all of this consumption, you can't really tell, because it's hidden in a folder over there that you'll never see because you're not with them on their computer all the time. They're using their computer at the Starbucks or something like that. And so they're carrying around this massive ton of images. So then I also thought about kind of our social lives and kind of some ways of visualizing those. So I spent some time at the Banff Institute for the Arts, where I took my Facebook wall, and I printed it out to the size of a wall. And it filled up a massive room, and that was just 1 month worth of content and posts. And I thought, this is interesting. We're making entire walls worth of information every single month through Facebook. But there's another civilization that used to do this, and it was reserved only for very important people, and that's the Egyptians. So the one big issue is that when you lose your Facebook account, or when the servers that host Facebook or Facebook goes out of style, or 10 or 20 years in the future, there's no more interesting posts on a wall. Nothing's been printed out, nothing's been saved. Whereas this has been around for 3,000 years. This is the best archiving you could do for civilization. So I'm worried a little bit about the fact that all of this is ethereal. The fact that you're accessing all of this information through these little portals, and it's hanging there in midair or in the cloud somewhere, or on some server racks, and it's all electrically displayed versus carved into stone, which is quite a bit more resilient over time. But the other thing is that people start to have these memories hyperlinked to their memories in their brains, and so now it's not, hey, what about that time when this happened? It's, oh no, I need to find this email to find this thing, and then you have to remember the search term, and then you have to go into your email and get that record, and so your brain becomes your computer becomes this external brain, and everyone suddenly becomes these persistent paleontologists, digging through all of the old emails, using their new search tools and booleans and/or operators, trying to get to the new or the old information rather, while thousands of emails start streaming in on top of it, burying the field site with more information and more emails, and it's a big mess. So Nick Rodriguez is this industrial designer, and he created this exhibit called Email Garden, which this is fake grass that grows at the same rate that he gets email. So, he left it there one day, and it was pretty short grass. Like, you can watch the grass grow, finally. And just the table started just getting covered, especially after this project came out and he got more and more emails. But he wanted to represent, the endless array of obligations that you have, that you can never stop the flow of email coming to your accounts, that you will just endlessly have these obligations. And it was kind of a... I get a little bit upset, because not only do you have this, but you have information jet lag. So, you're in one interface over here on Twitter, which has its own ecosystem and its own timeline, as in, you get back to somebody pretty quick on that surface. But then there's email, where maybe you can take 2 weeks to get back to somebody, and then there's another type of interface, and then there's SMS, and each one has their own time zone and their own person trying to get in touch with you on their own time zone. And so you have this jet lag that starts to appear. And when you put all of this together, it turns into a kind of panic. This was my email account after my TED talk. I definitely panicked. It was very difficult. So that's one of the examples of technology and its discontents. If you keep it for too long, it starts to turn against you and make you look kind of tacky over time, or at least have a bunch of people in an audience make fun of you 10 years later. But the other thing is that we're all technically superhumans, because we can click a button, hear all the way to the other side of the world, and then click the button and say, no, I don't want to see the other side of the world anymore. And we can do that from any point at any time until our device breaks. It's kind of like Van Gogh getting his ear cut off. Suddenly you can't hear. Suddenly you can't see. Suddenly your superhuman powers are taken away, and you have to borrow somebody else's superhuman powers next to you by borrowing their phone. Hi, can I be a cyborg? I lost my cyborg powers. I'm really sorry, please. And they're like, oh man, I hope he's not checking MySpace. That would take like 20 minutes. I don't have 20 minutes. And then I see a number of other people, I kind of think that cell phones are the new cigarettes, right? You see people stopping at a bus stop. Usually, they light a cigarette, they smoke it. But now, they just look at their phone because, like, oh, I have 5 minutes and I need something to do, and then they start poking around on the screen. Or, when the phone first came out, like the actual landline phone, it was this wonderful thing because you could go into a room and you could be very private and you could talk to somebody. And of course, people at the time, they said, oh no, everyone's going to go in rooms, close the doors, and not talk to anyone else again. It's going to be the most horrible thing possible. And they thought, society was doomed and dead and over because of the telephone. Well, of course, that didn't happen. People understand, telephones, you can walk out of the room, and then you can go back to the room and connect. But when the cell phone first came out, it was untethered from that room. It didn't have that piece of space around it. that former room did. So now everyone kind of has to space out and temporarily negotiate their private space. So this is one proposed solution for that. This is by the same guy, Nick Rodriguez, that created the email garden. He actually put this into a portable backpack. So if you buy one of these cool sculptures, you can walk, and then when you get up to line to the deli counter, you can just say, oh, sorry, flip it over your head and take your phone call. There's a video of him online doing this, where he's going up to the deli counters, going to nightclubs, and going on his phone with his cell phone booth walking around town. So with that, let me give you some history, because you know, if it is said that the future is unevenly distributed, then what I've been trying to do in my research is find where is that first point of unequal distribution? Who is the first person that's done this stuff, and how far can we go back where these ideas first happen? Because every time I look to what the future is, I look for, you know, some research institution that has a lot of funding that can create something that, you know, we'll have 40 years down the line. So I always go back in time as kind of a paleontologist of sorts to dig up that sort of information. So I found this guy. His name is Steve Mann. He is wearing 80 pounds of computer equipment. And he met his future wife around this time when he put metallic gel on his hair in order to conduct a signal. If you can see, he's wearing antenna right now so that he can get Wi-Fi, basically. He hacked into a building at MIT and put an antenna on top of it so he could get a local area signal so that he could walk around campus and live stream his life for a couple years. And that's every waking moment being uploaded in pictures on the internet. So you could go around and you could say, hey, Steve Mann, can you go check out that building over there? And he'd be like, sure, let me go around. And then you'd watch on the local network. It took him about a year to convince somebody else to also wear one of these assemblages. But he ended up writing this great paper. So if any of you are into wearable computing, you should read this guy's trials and tribulations, as in he wore these systems persistently for years at a time. And if any of you have made prototypes and you play with it for maybe 2 weeks or 4 weeks or 10 weeks versus wearing and living a system for years and years and reporting what works and what doesn't, this is fantastic. So one of the things that he hated is that, you know, on traditional computers, you have to be physically in a place and you have to, you know, scrunch your shoulders down and you have to type. And it's just really inhuman. You are the one becoming the computer when you're crouching over in front of a machine. You're not being a human. You're not being able to walk around and do the things you need to do. So your reality is actually very diminished. And so he said, that's not fair. I want to be able to have the computer conform to me, and I can wear the computer around, and then I can do whatever I want. So what he did is he really didn't like, for instance, advertising. So he said, I'm going to make a wearable heads-up display, and it's going to have a camera in one eye that takes in the world, a processing loop around the back of the head, and then input into my other eye filtered reality. He called this diminished reality. So here's him and his heads-up display detecting a sign and then replacing it with a text message from his wife that said, you went too far, turn left. So now, instead of advertising, he's able to see what he really wants to see. He didn't want to see other people's messages. He wanted to augment his own reality. So he did this also with a store. He'd walk into the store, and he would cancel out all the brands he didn't like, and so his shopping experience was very simple. He would just go into the store and just see what he wanted and grab all the items. And then his wife could also watch through his heads-up display and tell him, like, don't get that, don't get the milk, get the other milk. Here's an example of him canceling out a billboard to read one of the papers that he wrote and spell check it. But the question is, you know, how, you know, you think of like, okay, I'm wearing 80 pounds of equipment around, I'm doing computing, but one of the big issues is, how do you type? I mean, there's, you know, you don't want to have, like, there were these keyboards where you're typing on your legs and it looks like a keyboard and it's like part pants and then you can type on the subway. It's really hard to use. I wouldn't recommend it. So this device came out called the Twiddler a good deal of time ago. And Thad Starner and Steve Mann are the two people that really, really use this device. They can get up to, you know, 60 to 90 words a minute on this thing. It's one-handed. It has a mouse with your thumb, and you can play it like a guitar or a trumpet, and you can program in key chords. So say you want to put a mathematical equation in because you're writing a dissertation, like Steve Mann did while walking around in the park, writing his dissertation. Or, you know, now if you see him walk around Toronto, Canada, he's editing Wikipedia articles when he gets to a red light so that he has something to do while he's waiting to cross the street. So this is, an interesting way of inputting data. The big issue is that, this is very different from the keyboards, and it took a really long time for the keyboards to go away as is. He was also one of the first people to do a kind of contextual system. So, for instance, his wife could input, whenever you reach the star market, get a notification to pick up the milk. It's $1 million of research and equipment to have a very domestic purpose to it. Hey, remember the milk when you get to the store. And it wasn't until much later that people could actually do this with technology, but you'd have to use GPS. I mean, all of this was machine vision. It was very complicated and expensive to do. Another thing he did is he always forgot people's names and faces. So then he started just being able to remember them, and then he could pick up conversations and remember who they were. So some guy would show up, he'd be like, oh, I remember who you are, because it remembered who that guy was for him. But the main thing is that Steve Mann knew that he wouldn't be wearing 80 pounds of computer equipment forever. So eventually he said, it's going to be lighter and lighter over time. So here's the progression over time. So it goes 80 pounds, 40 pounds, 20 pounds, 10 pounds, and now it looks almost pretty cool in 1998 with all of that bundled into his sunglasses. And this is him now. He has it laser projected onto his eye, all of this data. It's very safe, although quite complicated to do. So it took a very long period of time for this type of technology to hit everyone's pockets in the form of phones. And we still don't have heads-up displays. Eventually, we may. And eventually, they'll make us look cooler than we are versus very strange-looking. And until that happens, it's going to be difficult to, wear glasses that give you information. And it wasn't until, GPS started hitting Sweden and Finland, and people started experimenting with location, that you could even do location-based reminder systems. But it was really expensive. The technology was really poor, really difficult to use. And then whenever a new piece of technology came out, people were doing things like trying to use old metaphors in the new technology. This made me so angry when I finally found this with this application, because not only does it not take advantage of what you can do, like instantaneously load a page, but it makes you push the page over, and sometimes the page doesn't go all the way over because you can't really touch it, and then it flips, and you have this crazy animation. So you're really looking at the page turn every single time you use this stupid book application. This makes me so mad, The same thing with a mouse. Like, the mouse doesn't really need to exist. And when Doug Engelbart invented it, he didn't expect it to last very long. He expected it to last, maybe a few years, and then something better would come along, and then it became persistent. So this persistent architecture that keeps existing is very dangerous, because it blocks any other new innovations. It blocks, the Twiddler from being a very useful device, so you can write your research paper while you're going through the park, instead of sitting there, in an attic somewhere drinking beer, hoping that, you finally get out of grad school so you can go outside. I didn't have that experience. So I like this instead. Flipboard makes me happy because it's a superhuman interface. It gives you lots of information, and it makes you feel like a superhuman when you use it. It loads the pages in the background, and it opens from the center. So it reduces the amount of time and space to get to that information. It's like, ah, what a freaking relief. Instead of these stupid skeuomorphs. It's dumb. Anyway, sorry. I have way too many opinions about that. So then I looked at, there's all this visual reality out there. There's all this visual stimulus on the web. What about other different forms of input, right? So you have this one-handed keycording device. So then I stumbled upon Kelly Dobson. And she said, why do we have machines? Why do we have machines learning the language of us? Why don't we learn the language of machines? So she made this blender. And what you do with this blender is you go up to it, and to turn it on, you go, rrrr. And then it turns on. My chief concern is if you have a dog in the house and it also growls. So there's some ambiguity there. Another one is Mika Satomi's. So what she did is she has this vest that you wear, and then it's attached to a video game. So somebody else gives you a massage, and they're actually like hitting the A, B button rapidly, and you're like, oh, what a nice massage, thanks. And they're like, no way, I'm totally killing on this game. And someone else is like, I want to play. And the whole time, somebody's using this vest to give somebody a massage, but also play a game at the same time. So it's a very dual purpose. I wanted them to do that with Farmville, where you could have like a real farm out there in another country, and then all these like, you know, 10-year-olds would be playing Farmville, and they would actually be growing real crops, and at the end of the month they'd get crops sent to them, you know, somehow. And you wouldn't have to, you know, bend over in a field and like pick it up. You'd have like machine vision figuring out all strawberries and like picking them and harvesting them, and you know, because people care about that more than real crops. So the next thing I want to talk about is some research from Xerox PARC in the 1970s, namely this one man named Mark Weiser. He had this idea of calm technology. And calm technology is literally just that. It's calm. It's in the background. It's relaxed. You know, I think that a lot of people, when they experience technology, when it goes wrong, it's a pain in the neck. It's stupid, crappy technology, and they get angry, and it makes them feel emotional, whereas calm technology is like, this just works. Great, I'm going to get on with my life. And so, you know, calm technology is defined as, you know, your actions in and of themselves become buttons. You know, you're not flipping through like 20 interfaces all the time trying to get to some action. It knows what you want. There's invisible interfaces that trigger when you do things that you want them to do. You know, it's not that it automatically happens all the time. It's that you set them up and that, you know, those things trigger. So one of them that I really like, a piece of calm technology, and it looks really dorky right now, so forgive the non-design, is the haptic compass belt. So this is a belt that you wear around your waist, and it always buzzes in the direction of north. So this is curious, right? Because what can you do with something like this? Well, the guy in Germany who started wearing this for about 6 weeks realized that as he biked around town, he always knew which direction was north, he always knew where his house was, he knew how far away he was from things, and then he also had the buzzing happen in his dreams as he was riding his bike in his dreams. And he realized that he had a sixth sense, that he suddenly had a new sense of direction without having to worry about looking at a map. So I said, well, this would be great. You could hook the system into GPS, and then you just get buzzed to the right or left when you need to take a right or left. And you don't have to look at your phone screen all the time when you're driving in your vehicle, and then you don't get in an accident because your attention is somewhere else. Because really, that visual channel needs to be compressed into another sense. It should be compressed into a belt or, you know, a thin red line that you follow in your wearable camera vision or something like that. You know, it shouldn't be in the visual space. It's very dangerous. So I really like that one. So speaking of location, I met my co-founder, Aaron Parecki, who's sitting in the front row and probably embarrassed now that I pointed at him. after I learned that he was tracking his location persistently in the background at 5-second intervals for 2.5 years. And I said, why do you do this? And he said, well, it's interesting because I can make pictures like this. So this is a graph of everywhere he's been in Portland. It's about 2.5 million GPS points that are merged together to make this graph. And I don't know if you can see the colors on it, but there's like a red color, and that's him going really fast on highways, so it's colored by speed. And then there is the green mark of him going a little bit slower. And then if you can see the really dark colors in the top left, that's him driving around looking for parking, going really slow. So I said, well, what can you do with this kind of persistent background location? Like, once you get, you know, information like this, what can you do? And he said, well, it's very interesting. What you can do is you can, you know, you can make invisible buttons. And I said, wait a second, because I had been studying, you know, okay, you have the solid buttons, and then you have a liquid display with all these buttons on it, and then suddenly this button is air. It's solid liquid air. Okay, what can you do with this? And he said, well, you can do more interesting things, like you could leave a message in a place, and then, you know, when I get to that place, I'll get the message. I said, okay, cool. Can I try this out? So I started tracking my location. When I got back from New York in like 2009 on this little Boost mobile phone. Like, I didn't have a GPS in an iPhone or Android phone, so I couldn't use it. And I started walking around town, and I let people leave me messages. And one of the first messages I got was like, look, to your right, raspberries. And I looked to my right, and there was a giant raspberry bush. So I said, okay, I'm going to eat all these raspberries. I was like, this is a very curious experience. And then I kept walking, and then suddenly it was, hey, look, it's the Burnside Bridge. You know, it was built in 1923, and 50,000 people go across it every day. It's kind of this annotated reality. And so then I asked Aaron, can you do more things? And he said, yeah. He said, I set up this smart home a few years ago, and I put a geofence around the house. So when I got home, the lights would automatically turn on because my phone would tell the house that I'm home, and then when I left, the lights would automatically turn on. turn off, so I didn't have to worry. Or I could say to the housemates, like, I'm 5 minutes away from being home. So this whole thing was that, you know, the phone became this kind of remote control for reality, where, you know, you could remember, of course, to turn off and on the lights, but it's really nice when you get home to not come home to a dark house. And of course, you can always press the off button and if you want to do a surprise party for somebody. Don Norman was like, what if you want to do a surprise party? I was like, he's like, I'm going to break your logic with a surprise party. I was like, well, if you did a surprise party, Don, you could turn it off and it's okay. And he's like, well, that's a rule-based architecture. It could have flaws. I was like, well, yes, that's why you have the off button. It's okay. It's okay. So some of the other things that you could do is, you know, say you're taking a trip and you get... And you're on the bus, you could put a geofence right before your bus stop and then tell your phone to wake you up. Say, hey, wake up, your bus stop is here, get off. And then when you got off the bus, you could get a message about the house that you're supposed to go to and how to get there. And so during the bus ride, instead of watching the little blue dot all the way up and then being like, it's a new city, I don't know where I am, am I supposed to get off here or here? And then, you know, you look out the window because it's a new place and you're really excited and then you miss the dot and then you miss your stop and you walk like 10 blocks in the wrong direction. You could just sit there looking at the scenery and it would tell you, hey, you should get off now. And you'd be like, okay, great. And then you'd get off. Like that sort of thing where you're using this in the background so that you help your life and you don't have as much, you know, intensity on, you know, being on the screen all the time. I just find that I miss all of my life when I look at the screen all the time and that there's a better way to do it. So here's another example of... So we built this little platform called GeoLoki, and we started playing with it. So we had a bunch of hackathons, and one of our designers built this app that takes all the TriMet bus data from Portland, Oregon. And what it does is whenever you walk up to a bus stop, it knows you're waiting for the bus, and it sends you the next bus that's going to come. And so you don't have to dig through your pocket and remember the code to text to get the next bus if there's no bus arrival information. Just gives you that information. Another thing we did is we took all the geocoded Wikipedia articles through InfoChimps, and we put them all into GeoLoki, and then you could walk around town and suddenly you would get all the Wikipedia articles near you. And so before, and I know a bunch of people have done this, you'd have to remember the app was there, and then you'd have to load it, and then you'd have to search and do a local search, and you'd have to wait for the pins on the map to show up. And then by that time, you know, you forgot that you were next to this building that you wanted to know more about. So I've lived in Portland for 6 years, and on the first day I tried this out, I walked around, and suddenly it was, hey, there's a building next to you, and it was built in 1850 by an ice cream tycoon, and here's his life story, and I just sat there reading about this building. But I didn't have to remember the app was there. I didn't have to remember anything. I just got interesting information. So the idea behind this is that the interface completely disappears. And that, you know, your actions are reduced as a human, your computer-like actions that you've technically had for years, and that you don't have to ask questions all the time of, you know, Google or ask an app a question all the time. So then more people came up with more interesting things. So Reed Bills came up with one where he took the restaurant inspection scores of all the places in town, and he made an app called Don't Eat That, which was you walk by a place and it tells you what not to eat. The inspection score is very low. So I used that one, and I learned that the place I had gone a lot was actually not very good. So one of the other things, one of our developers, Kyle Drake, made this thing called the pinball layer. And the biggest issue I have right now is that we're really accustomed to the web. The web is freaking amazing because you can have giant sets of data in it. And in the case of this website, there was a bunch of pinball machines and pinball data in there. And it wasn't you weren't able to actually get any of it out. As in, if you want to look where pinball machines are, you have to load the interface, and then you have to see if there are any pinball machines nearby, or you know, any data set, happy hours, or anything like that. And you can't do that when you're walking around. So this allows you to take that data and actually put it with context and put it next to location. So then we said, what happens if you put a bunch of geofences on a map and you turn it into a real-life game of Pac-Man using the city streets? So we built that. Oh, that was one of the first hackathons. It's kind of a tribute to Dennis Crowley's Pac-Manhattan because we played that at a conference in 2008. It was awesome. But there was no way to do it with geofence technology because GPS was really poor on phones at that point in time. So we debuted this at Stanford University, and I drew all of these tiny little dots with different number values on them So if you go through like the 50-pointer, you get 50 points, and then your team is awesome. I didn't know the campus before I went. So I started drawing all these points, and I ended up putting a bunch of 50-pointers in a construction site. And no one could get in. So one of the players, he ended up showing up and looking through the metal fence and saying, "No, it's a construction site. I can't get to this point." And so he asked one of the construction workers, "Hey, can you just hold my phone for a minute and wait till it says 50 points?" And the guy was like, "Yeah, I'll take your phone, sure." And so he took his phone and he said, "Hey, I got 50 points. What the heck are you guys doing?" and the construction worker was like, "You know, the whole time at Stanford University, nobody has shown up and talked to any of us, and we have no idea what they're doing, you know, poking around at their phones all the time. And nobody has, like, run around fervently and had a good time." And I think of it like when you're a little kid, you make a game like this, right? You say, "First one of the tree gets 200 points, and everybody mad dashes, and before you know it, you've all run 6 miles, and you're in really good shape. And adults are definitely not like that because they don't create games like that as much anymore, unless there's like a corporate anthropologist who comes in and says, "Games day, it's awesome, training and leadership, let's run around," and then it's okay because everyone feels really awkward. But in this case, everyone did run 3 miles and they were happy and they felt like kids and it was good because their phones were helping them on. There are a number of issues from doing stuff like this that we found out as we built a bunch of little experiments. And it was really upsetting because we kind of realized through this, we said, well, why isn't this stuff from the 1970s and 1980s just ubiquitous? Why can't we have all this cool technology right now? Why aren't people building more things like this? And so we were kind of trying to figure out, like, what underlying this all is a big issue. And one of the biggest ones was battery drain. How many of you have used a location-based app and had to turn it off because of the battery? Well, it's most everybody. So this was the biggest issue. So we said, you know, there's this issue and there's going to be 50 billion of these connected devices by 2020. This is going to be an even bigger issue when everybody has their own cool operating system that you can develop on and all of your developer toolkits and it's just a mess. And that, you know, we found out that these are really big problems. And people we talked to, they said, "Well, yeah, we've wanted to do the, you know, I call it the, what is it, the Starbucks dilemma. Like, I used to make a drinking game around marketing conferences about this. Like, when you walk by Starbucks, you get a location-based ad." And then I said, "Do you want an app that does that?" And people are like, "Well, no. Well, you know, somebody would want that, and let's make that app." You know, and it was always this, like, drinking game because they would always cite that example. I said, "Well, why isn't it done yet? You know, why isn't this an issue? There's this underlying issue in the platform itself, not in all these apps. I mean, you can build an app like this. It just takes a heck of a long time. Most people internally don't have resources to deal with all of the, you know, the issues around the trial and error of, oh, no, there's no network connection. Now what do you do? How do you store location data on the device, and then when it wakes up, then you give them something? Or how do you figure out if somebody's in a geofence or not? Or how do you store all the data that comes off of the phone? Or how do you handle the battery in the background so that it ramps down when you're not around anything interesting and ramps up when it is? So there's all these issues. And so I kind of thought around the next generation of location being, well, it's ambient, it's in the background, it's doing things to help you versus... You know, and also that, you know, these problems technically would be solved. So what we did was we tried to make this little platform, which we call GeoLoki, and there are dinosaurs around if you want any of them. You've probably seen them around at some point. But we tried to make this platform to solve some of these core problems so that we could finally have this sort of ecosystem where you don't have to worry about this stuff anymore. And we knew that we needed some help. So I would like to announce right now that we are partnering with three very interesting companies to help bring this whole future, which is actually 30 and 40 years ago at Park Research, to the present, which it's taken a really long time to get here. So the first one is with AppCelerator. So AppCelerator is a fantastic company. They have the Titanium platform. They have a global network of 1.5 million users. They just have a great toolkit, and I know that a lot of people there have been asking for a really nice turnkey geo solution with geo analytics and geofencing, things like that, and so it's a really nice natural fit. So we'll be rolling out some partnership with them. The next one is with factual, because the issue is that whenever you make a location-based app, you need some sort of context. You need data. And they're really great at providing that. They have a set of about 60 million data points in 50 countries that you can use. So then you could say, you know, here's all the databases of every Safeway. And when I have my shopping list, anytime I'm near a Safeway, give me the shopping list for Safeway, because that's the store that I use. And the next one is with Locade. They're the largest location as a service company. They have access to 350 million devices in their network. And so you know, now their customers have access to a real-time toolkit from us. And also, you know, they've been asking for same kind of real-time hybrid solution. You know, there's carrier location, which allows you to get information off devices. And then there's this real-time location infrastructure that kind of comes with that. And so it's a real natural fit with them, and we're really happy to announce those three partnerships. So the main point of this is that the best technology is invisible and just gets out of the way and lets you live your life. And so the idea is that it's no longer this, because that's 80 pounds and nobody wants to wear that, but this. This is a bunch of people playing the math attack game and getting the 50 pointers and jumping up and down. And you can't see any computers on them at all. They're living in actual reality where they're not tied to a desktop machine. They're using mobile and there's something happening that means something to them. So thank you very much. So if you want, there is a short Q&A, and I don't know where the microphone is. Somebody point me to. This person will tell you.
Microphone is right here, center
so if you'd
house.
Like to ask questions, we'll wait a little bit. People that come up.
Great. Hi, Amber.
Hey, how's it going?
Doing well. I of course really love the solid to liquid to air metaphor, and you know what. One of those kind of experience design kind of questions that's been kind of burning on my head lately, and probably yours as well, is if you kind of think about the physical part of the solid interface, and you think about the kind of technology kind of part of the liquid interface. So, you know, we have this stage where we're, you know, technology, the experiences are kind of, you have to play around with the technology. And you're kind of talking about how the interface is now, or it's turning into this kind of invisible, no longer there kind of interface. The complicated question to me, and I'm curious to know how you've thought about this, is there are very important things about physical things, and there are very important things about not physical things, you know, digital things. And how have you come to think about creating experiences that take the best parts of those, and you know, are not completely digital, not completely invisible, and not completely, you know, intangible, but somehow are both.
All right, so the question was about how do you figure out how somebody can have the best elements of analog and the best elements of digital in whatever they're building? And the answer is that each person discovers it for themselves. Maybe there's 10 or 20 apps that somebody builds or some group of people that build, and they figure it out by trial and error. That's why, you know, building apps is supposed to be, you know, easy, that you have this ecosystem that shows up, and you end up seeing, you know, what works really well, what's very innovative. You know, you get, like with the iPhone, like one of the first apps was the fart app, you know, that's like a very interesting example. But that was the first thing that people figured out they could do with the interface. And I think you figure it out through playing with it. And the more fun you have with the device, the more interesting things come out. And then those become serious things over time.
Appreciate it. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Joey. I'm a professor down in San Antonio. And I just kind of had a question, like, all the ideas you're talking about are things that all of my friends and everybody's been working on for the past, like you said, 5 or 6 years, intently, especially with the geocaching and things like that. How do you feel, you know, privacy plays a role in this? Because as academics, because I'm an academic as well, it's fun in games and we're like running around and kind of like hipstering it up. Yeah. And but I mean, the stuff you're talking about has real implications once it goes into practice. Like, when we're playing in the lab, it's all fun and games. Like the Stanford guy, you know, they're all excited. Yeah. But I mean, this is stuff that can be really used for all types of crazy stuff. And I don't want to go there. I'm just saying, like, what do you think? I mean,
yeah. Well, in some cases, I mean, we've seen that some people are really interested in having eyes on the ground, as in they have a group of people that are like 20 people who are in dangerous situations, And in that case, having somebody know where they are is really useful. I think with any new technology, you know, people are going to try to use it for, you know, the whole spectrum of things. But I think right now, you know, people are pretty well aware of, you know, what they want to do is they just don't want to be surprised. So as long as you give them a system in which they're not surprised, or you say, here's exactly what's being done with your data, or we destroy your data, or you get this in return, or it goes into the silo, or you get it back as a downloadable file that you can use to make cool analytics with. I mean, that sort of thing where you're very transparent is really important. So, you know, the systems that have tried to do that before, where it hasn't been an issue, haven't had any rules around that. So they've kind of botched it, you know? And so I think the most important thing is that there's a dialogue being opened in this industry that people are really interested in like looking at. And the only time in which something can move and something can happen is when that dialogue shows up and there's all of these, you know, systems that are tried out and worked around. Thanks.
Hey, Amber, Benedict. So I thought the haptic compass was really interesting. And I remember reading an article, I can't remember all of the details. It involved a study of two native tribes that used, within their language, to refer to senses of direction. They actually had words that referred to each cardinal direction. It wasn't straight or forward or left or right. And they put these individuals into a confined environment, into a closed rooms that had completely blacked out windows in which they had no ability to perceive exactly which direction was which. And without fail, every single time, even after spinning them around to disorient them, they were able to identify what was north, south, east, and west, because awesome. Built into their linguistics, they determined direction in a different way. So I wasn't surprised that this gentleman who was wearing the haptic compass was able to essentially cultivate an intuitive ability based on that feedback that we simply lose the sensory perception of based on this bombardment of technology. Right. So I'd be interested in your thoughts of other types of intuitive abilities we might be able to cultivate by using these types of haptic responses. And
that's a good question.
You know, living in a wheelchair, proprioception and kind of the perception of my body and its orientation is something I think a lot about. So I didn't know if you could touch on that.
Well, thank you first for talking about the tribes that have an innate sense of direction. That's fantastic. I broke my leg and was in a wheelchair for about 6 or 8 months in 2010. And so I had this completely different sense about it. I think the other one that people are probably missing is the sense that other people are around you. I think it's kind of screwing things up where, you know, especially you can see in like something like Portland, or like you go next to somebody and you need to get through, but they have no idea that somebody is around them and needs to get through. Whereas in New York, you just make space for people and you're constantly negotiating space. And so it's this sense that I think might, you know, be missing in some spaces and really hyper-aware in other spaces in which you have a lot of people. So thank you for your question. I'll take two more questions, unless people want me to answer more. Go ahead.
Hi, my name's Ying.
Hi.
So you're providing a really fun interface for application developers like myself to play with. And my question is, how do you, you know, how do you intend to curate the sensory inputs that, you know, you're going to get from all these application developers, you know, playing with the API? And suppose two of them thought that, you know, vibrating your phone would be a good way to let you know about something. So how would you know? You know, how do you educate the user that, you know, it's actually this guy telling you this versus something else?
Can you rephrase that question really quick?
So the question is, how would a user, given that I don't have an interface, how do I know that, you know, whatever I'm receiving,
Right, good question. So there's a number of different ways. I mean, one, you could use a push notification, right? So you could say or an SMS. But the other one, you could say a different type of ding, right? So you could say like a Morse code type thing. You've got three dings for this friend and two dings for this other guy. Or you have, you know, if there's a pinball machine nearby, it sounds like a pinball machine. Or you could have a buzz, you know. So different types of things.
But now it seems like, you know, there's going to be a lot of things happening and you're going to be very confused.
Yeah, it's true. I think that hopefully, unless you know, like, kids showing up using this technology will probably just subscribe to everything. And then there'll be like you'll know when a kid's around because they'll just sound really noisy maybe. People usually, you know, kind of curate what they're consuming. And that, you know, they can subscribe and unsubscribe. Eventually people get their own favorite apps and their own favorite, you know, notification systems. Like, I would never want to be notified by phone unless it was Delta Airlines trying to tell me that my flight was canceled, right? So usually, push notification or text tends to work pretty well, or, you know, an activity stream. But for different stuff, if you're playing a game, you definitely need, like, sounds or buzzes or something so you can keep it in your pocket and run around. So thank you for your question.
We have time for two more.
Okay.
Hi, I'm Ben, and I was just kind of as a combination of the last two questions. You gave the example of how we can obviously lose senses, like the sense people are around us, yeah. And we have limited input, at least, and it'll take us time to learn things. Assuming this takes off at an exponential rate and we start getting options for infinite senses, do you have any predictions about what happens as not just some of us have different senses and lose senses and have to deal with that, but it becomes a bigger thing? Something gets deprecated and now five of my senses don't work. And my senses, I have like 30 and they have 40 and only half of them match.
That's a very good question. So what happens when you have what happens if people get all these different kinds of senses, and then what happens if suddenly they're all deprecated? And one of the big issues around that is, you know, you get completely different channels of people. My favorite book on this is Feed by M.T. Anderson. It's like a young adult fiction novel, which is about, you know, some kid who's only 2 years older than his little brother, and they all are tuned into different notification systems, and so they all speak different languages, and they all have different gestural systems, and they all have different speech patterns, and that only, you know, a few years apart, they're already a completely different tribe. Or the quote that, you know, that the new world is kind of an over proximity of all things, that there's kind of a new form of schizophrenia where everything is happening at once. I feel that at some point there's so much that people end up doing extremes where they say no more email, like Dana Boyes, like no more email vacation, and everything goes to the trash. Where you say, I just have to stop. They have an increasing amount of like summer camps in other countries where they say, okay, everybody, no technology at all for a month. Let's go learn how to climb trees. Because your mental, you know, your mental self is getting so overstimulated and the physical self isn't as much, which is why I'm really a proponent of, you know, the kind of location-based context that allows you to walk around and be embodied in your world instead of sitting there at a two-dimensional screen. So thank you so much for your question.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Ben Kittrell with Live On. We're trying to solve the digital dark age problem, but I had a question about all of this information. If I'm walking around, I'm having everything pop up. Is there a solution to in mind of how to? I don't want to have to unsubscribe from all these different things. And is there like a curation type way of narrowing down the amount of data that's being pushed at me?
Yeah, I mean, right now it's unsubscribe from this email, try not to get as much junk mail. I think there's always going to be the over-proximity of all things type issue where, you know, maybe there might be a thing where you could say on your phone, only 5 notifications, and then internally the system would rank, you know, what you're interested in. But then that's always an issue because then a computer is thinking for you, and that's always bad because the computer is not a human. There's no history of being a human in the computer, and humans are really good at curating and machines aren't as much. So I think really it's just going to be a necessary evil where it's like when you walk through a jungle and there's a bunch of different bugs and you have to make sure you're not bit by a bunch of bugs. You know, having an everyday life with technology, there's all sorts of crappy bugs and a bunch of stuff that you don't want and a whole information trail and a bunch of people asking you for, you know, to connect on some social interface that you don't care about and you keep getting emails on it, you know. I think hopefully people will get so annoyed with those systems that they'll make laws around not being able to spam people with those systems, hopefully. But thank you for your question.
Thank you.
That was our last question. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone.